Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
At next.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The war against terrorism brought unprecedented practices and new institutions to the American legal landscape. But keeping the country safe also means protecting the rights and principles it was founded on. Tonight on Point, striking a balance between security and liberty. But first, Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that Iran is deceiving the United States and secretly continuing activities to build nuclear weapons. Iran has said that its nuclear activities are confined to generating nuclear fuel. Howard LaFranchi has been following the story for the Christian Science Monitor and joins me now. Welcome, Howard.
Thanks for having me on, Gail.
Howard, let me ask, first of all, how serious is this, and is this anything new?
Well, I think, first of all, what Colin Powell was saying is partly comes in response to some revelations that came out of Paris yesterday from an Iranian dissident group there that was claiming that Iran is pursuing reprocessing and enrichment of nuclear materials in a site that has heretofore been unknown by international authorities. That claim was picked up on somewhat by Powell on his way down to meetings in Chile, where he told reporters that from his knowledge that Iran is pursuing the weapon systems that would be capable of delivering nuclear arms. Now, in both those cases, those are not new. In the case of the Iranian dissident group, their claims are new in terms of a new site, if that turns out to be accurate. But it's been known that Iran has been developing weapons delivery systems for the past couple of decades. So what Powell seemed to be saying that was new was that that he had evidence that that what they were trying to develop was weapon systems that could deliver nuclear warheads.
Well, as you say, Howard, if it turns out to be accurate, we've certainly had reason in recent months to become a little wary of reports like this. How definitive is this intelligence, in your view?
Well, first of all, a number of nuclear arms specialists were rather quick to say we need to be careful with information from this group. It's called the National Council for Resistance in Iran, the People's Mujahideen, another name, and they are, in fact, on the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Now, they've been accurate in the past on some of their information, but as some of these arms experts noted, they would have every interest to come out with information at this particular point because, as you know, just last week, the Iranians agreed to suspend enrichment programs in exchange for economic aid and things from a number of European countries, and it could be an effort to forestall or to even doom those agreements. Then, of course, you seem to be referring to information or experience that we've all had over the past couple of years, where intelligence has turned out to be not all that accurate. Intelligence that has been acted on has turned out to be not all that accurate. So a number of experts seem to be saying, that this information that needs to be taken with some skepticism.
Well, given all of that, what do you think the U.S. should do, or what might it do?
Well, I think the U.S., there is an international Atomic Energy Agency meeting coming up that where this will be reviewed. The U.S. is watching what the Europeans have come up with. For the past couple of years, the U.S. has been pressing for sanctions against Iran. The U.S. says that everybody agrees that Iran should not be allowed to develop and to possess or to become a nuclear power. the problem with going to sanctions and becoming tougher, of course, is that the U.S. also needs a certain amount of cooperation from Iran on Iraq. Iran has tremendous influence on what will happen in Iraq, and that's really at the top of the U.S. agenda for the next few months. So while the U.S. wants to certainly wants to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons, at the same time, they don't want to push them in a corner, at least not yet.
Well, finally, Howard, President Bush is going to be joining Powell in Santiago for the Asia-Pacific Economic Conference. Who's going to be there, and what does the president hope to accomplish?
Yeah, this is an annual meeting of, as you said, the APEC countries, all the countries along the Asian and Pacific Rim. And in recent, this has always been an economic group of countries getting together, and ever since 9/11, it has taken on more of a security edge and interest in security affairs. That will continue this year, but Colin Powell says that that President Bush's number one interest is in getting these the countries in this organization that include most of the world's or many of the world's economic powerhouses to refocus on international trade talks and to get those moving again.
Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Howard LaFranchi is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from Washington. When planes hit the two towers and the Pentagon on September 11th, the American judicial machine went into war mode. The safety of the country was at stake, and everything else was secondary. Foreign terrorist attacks were still somewhat new to America, and as the country scrambled to prevent another, the rules of the game were made up on the fly. New threats meant new approaches, but the legality of those practices was open to interpretation by those who prosecute the war. Clear rules prevent confusion, and without them, things can go wrong. Things like interrogations at Abu Ghraib or innocent people being held for months with no outside contact. Well, now Harvard University has pulled the collective input of some heavy hitters in the war on terrorism in a new report recommending a clear set of guidelines going forward. This hour on Point, fighting against terrorism without losing what makes us America. Where do you draw the line between safety and freedom? Are rules on torture and assassination an obstacle to fighting terrorism or a safeguard of the American way? Should the president have the flexibility to create the rules as we go along, or should America have clearly defined regulations for the war on terrorism? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Juliet Kayyem, Executive Director for Research at Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and co-director of Harvard's Long-Term Legal Strategy Project for Preserving Security and Democratic Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. Phew.
That's a mouthful right there.
Welcome, Juliet. Good to have you with us.
Good evening.
Tell us first, why was a long-term legal strategy project needed in the first place?
Well, my co-director, Phil Hyman, from Harvard Law School, who was also Deputy Attorney General, and I have done a lot of work together. And at some stage, maybe about 18 months ago, we realized, despite our political background or our political affiliations, that there seemed to be a growing consensus within the legal community, and in particular the national security legal community, that we, for a while, had been in a sprint, especially those immediate months and even years after 9/11, but that if the terrorist threat is going to last my lifetime and probably my children's lifetime, that we had to think about reasserting the rule of law into even, yes, a war on terrorism. We don't like the word war on terrorism. And how to do that and how to get sort of broad bipartisan support for looking at some of the hardest issues, some of the most difficult to talk about, And so we thought, let's bring together some of the smartest people we know from both sides of the aisle, people who've been in national security, intelligence, military, law enforcement for years, people who had worked for this administration, for the previous one, and think about the details. And I think that's the most important thing that came out of this was everyone talks about the balancing act. The 911 Commission report, over 400 pages long, has 2 pages on the balancing of civil liberties and national security, because very few people get into the details. And to be honest, this administration simply asserts its commander-in-chief authority not only fight a war, a real war in Afghanistan or Iraq, but to also detain people indefinitely or, for example, to ignore the ban against torture. And so we sort of got this group together over the course of 14 or 15 months and came up with the recommendations that Phil Hyman and I take full ownership of, but that have sort of broad support by the group and are quite detailed.
Well, in fact, we're going to be going through some of those details a little later in the hour. But it is interesting, in reading the report, you get a real sense of a lot of people just wrestling with this, as you say, with the details, because there certainly has been a lot of lip service paid to the need to balance security and democracy. But you're right. It's been a little vague.
Right. I mean, this is where Ashcroft and the director of the ACLU would both agree, right? They could sit in a room and say yes, but then when you get to the details, no one would agree. And the truth is people are reading this report and we're getting criticized from the left and we're getting criticized from the right.
Which tells you you did it right.
Maybe. It depends on where your friends are. But, you know, I think that's not so bad. And, I mean, the purpose of this is obviously it's a group of people who have a lot of experience and know things that that not any single individual will know. For example, the guys from the military and the military legal community are, you know, sort of very concerned about how the Uniform Code of Military Justice would play into how we prosecute the war on terrorism or military commissions and military tribunals. Very specific details like that that would have never sort of crossed my mind, and I think that that's helpful. Our goal, of course, is Congress. Our goal is not this executive branch or, if carried one, that administration. That Congress for too long has been silent, I think, pathetically silent on these issues. I mean, look at us. We're almost 6 months after the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, and still Congress hasn't set any rules or guidelines. And what we hear from the national security community, the guys out in the field and the military lawyers and everything else, is the truth is that the rules are actually better for national security, right? Because now, I think most guys out in the field are very fearful of doing any interrogations because they're fearful that they're going to cross some imaginary line that they don't know, when the truth is they could probably do a lot without crossing a line, but we owe it to them to tell them where the line is.
Put us in the room as these arguments were, or these discussions, excuse me, probably arguments. You know, was there some pounding on the table?
Yeah, I mean, and I think various members were concerned we were either going too far to the left or too far to the right. But that's, you know, the nice thing about not being in power, which none of us were, Republicans and Democrats, was you can try to come to some resolution. But the truth is that on the nitty-gritty details, I mean, I'm not sure we could hold any one of the members to any one of the details. I think only Phil Hyman and I could be held accountable for them. But I think overall, this notion that we have to stop sprinting and we have to think about the marathon. And I think it's now sort of a bipartisan sentiment. And it's a sentiment, to be honest here, it's a sentiment that at least 8 of the 9 Supreme Court justices agree with now, too. I mean, after the Supreme Court came down with a series of rulings this summer, at least 8 of them bought onto the notion that the commander-in-chief authority did not had to have some structure, that you couldn't simply assert that this is a war, especially war like this that's not limited in geography or time or anything like that.
Kind of a not so fast, Mr. President.
Right. It was sort of like that, except for Justice Thomas. He was still in the pro executive branch.
Well, there are many fascinating aspects of this that we're going to continue talking about after a break, and including things like torture and assassination and detention of people. So we are going to continue our discussion in just a moment.
All the fun stuff,
right? Absolutely. We're continuing our discussion in a moment about the tension between security and liberty. and about a new report from Harvard University that's recommending some new rules for the war against terrorist groups. And we ask you, where do you draw the line between safety and civil liberties? Should government agents be able to secretly attend your religious or political meeting? Should people have to submit to fingerprinting and optical scans when going into high target areas? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about how to strike a balance between security and civil liberties, and about a new report that offers a set of rules for the war against terrorist groups. Should the president have free rein to decide on issues like torture and assassination? Are you willing to relinquish some of your liberties for greater safety? And where do you draw the line between security and freedom? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have in the studio this hour Juliet Kayyem, co-director of Harvard University's Long-Term Legal Strategy Project for Preserving Security and Democratic Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. And also joining us now, Emily Bazelon, senior editor of Legal Affairs and visiting lecturer at Yale Law School, also a Soros Justice Media Fellow. Emily, welcome to you.
Thanks very much.
I want to check in with you in just a second, Emily, but I want to ask Juliet first about, let's start on one of the juicier topics here, and that is torture. Give me, if you will, the security viewpoint on this and the democratic freedoms viewpoint, and then we can go to Emily and find out some of the real cases that illustrate why you needed to think about this in this way.
Well, first of all, no one knows what torture is. I mean, you know it when you see it, but there's no clear rules about what is torture, highly coercive interrogation tactics. The security interest is, of course, the scenario in which you have the guy who knows where the nuclear bomb is planted and you need to do really physically destructive things on him and to him to get the information from him. I mean, that's the sort of, you know, Kiefer Sutherland 24 analogy. It doesn't always work out that way. But to be fair to the national security side, it also highly coercive interrogation techniques are often needed to manipulate physically and psychologically people who may have information, for example, about the resistance in Iraq. The sort of democratic freedoms viewpoint is clearly that, one, there's no evidence that any of this ever works, that people are just willing to lie when they're faced with intensive interrogation tactics. And two, what have we become when we you know, create a system in which this is permissible? It seemed to us, I mean, there was, and of course, we met and talked about this before Abu Ghraib broke. I mean, you know, one of the things about being in that community is all of us had been hearing stories about, gosh, there was lots of deaths on Guantanamo Bay, or what is really happening to these guys that we're hearing they're picking? I mean, everyone had been hearing stories in the community that something was not going right, and it took the breaking of the Abu Ghraib story for it to sort of see what had happened. And
well, let me ask you to hold off on the recommendations, because that's certainly an important piece of it, if that's where you were heading. It sounded like you were. Yeah. Well, hold off on that for just one second, because, Emily, I want to turn to you and ask why we just heard a couple of examples, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Are those the real cases that you think of as well to illustrate why torture in particular might need to be addressed?
I think those are two important cases. I was just in Jordan doing some reporting about the Guantanamo detainees, and some of them had been held en route to Guantanamo at Bagram Air Force Base, a large military prison in Afghanistan where there are estimated between 2,000 and 6,000 prisoners. And people were telling very serious stories about torture there. So I think there's also a concern that given the Supreme Court's rulings giving some due process protections to prisoners at Guantanamo, that there may be other military prisons around the world at which torture is occurring.
All right, Juliet, so after you folks wrestled with this for a while, what did you come up with? What were your recommendations?
Well, a couple things. I mean, one is I don't think anyone no one would endorse, and in fact, the administration no longer endorses the notion that torture is ever permissible, even though there was that infamous, now infamous, torture memo that suggested that the president could walk away from the Convention Against Torture. next to that, though, there are these things called, there's this series of sort of cruel and unusual and degrading treatment of prisoners that
a la Abu Ghraib.
Right. And even, probably even less than that. I mean, that, a lot of that sort of reached the torture level, but that that are prohibited by the Convention Against Torture with caveats. I mean, that's what a lot of people don't recognize, that that countries should do everything to not utilize them, but if in self-defense, a country may be able to utilize them. And in that instance, we basically say, if you're going to use those sort of more intense interrogation techniques, you have to have a presidential finding. What does that mean to the layperson listening right now? It means actually the president has to be politically responsible for the individual that it's going to be used against. So you would never be used against 1,000 people. So if the guy knows where the nuclear bomb is, we understand there could be, in the remote possibility, that situation. Okay, then the president can sign off. The more important part is all the other interrogation techniques that fall in between what we allow our cops to do and what's prohibited by the torture conventions. That's an incredibly gray area. No one's ever tried to designate what that area is. We leave it to our guys out in the field to try to figure it out. The guidelines that went out to our guys on the field were changing almost daily because no one tried to So basically what we recommend is more process than substance, is that it would require, for example, the Attorney General to promulgate what in fact are the interrogations that can be used, how can they be used, against whom they can be used, only be used against unlawful prisoners of war. The duration, because that's important. Something that's used for a day may not be highly, you know, coercive, but if it's used for a week, it is. The combination of techniques. And then we put in a series of procedural steps that would have to occur before any of these highly coercive interrogation techniques are approved. The fact that they're being used would have to be disclosed to the intelligence committees. I mean, what we basically put in there is a process of oversight, which doesn't exist right now. And one of the concerns is why the national security, I mean, this is, you know, these are not fair designations, but why sort of the hardcore national security people want this now, is what we're starting to hear out in the field is that, right, no interrogations are taking place now after Abu Ghraib, or a lot of them aren't. And that's probably not good either. And I think it's true that everyone sort of agrees we owe it to folks to figure out what that process should be. This gives a lot of flexibility to the executive branch, but doesn't just leave it to them.
Emily, does that make sense to you from your perspective?
I think it's important to allow interrogations to go forward, certainly. But I think one of the important things Juliet is saying is that there needs to be a distinction made between rare instances in which coercion is really necessary to protect against immediate threat and sort of more run-of-the-mill practices. My sense has been that one of the problems with the Bush administration's current policies have been that some coercive tactics, especially at Abu Ghraib, but also at Guantanamo, have really been used to the point of overuse.
Let's go on to targeted killing. One might say that's a euphemism for assassination.
Really?
Make the security argument and right. Make the freedom argument for us, Juliet.
Yeah, this is one of those areas where almost everyone we talk to, no one knows what the rules are, because as everyone knows, most people know that there's a traditional ban against assassination in this country coming out of all the crazy attempts by the CIA to get Castro in the 1950s and 60s. But that ban is often known more for its exceptions than the rule itself. The president can create a covert exception to it, which Clinton clearly did, that there was a targeted killing memorandum to get bin Laden. And so no one actually knows right now, does the executive order against assassination still exist, because there's rumors that Bush may have rescinded it secretly. And this was a field, so just to step back a minute, this was a field where we sort of just stepped into it. We don't know what the lay of the land is. But look, I mean, the national security viewpoint is, you know, there are going to be people in countries that we can't get any other way, that the country is not going to be helpful to get them. We are going to be in situations where that individual needs to be killed. You can't simply invade every country. I think Democratic Freedom's viewpoint is clearly, I mean, once again, is, well, is probably the Israeli example mostly, which is right. I mean, one, it seems like for every Hamas killer that Israel gets, four more are born. And two, I mean, for every Hamas leader you supposedly get, you also tend to get four bystanders. That it often doesn't work. For us, it was, this is another instance where it will be highly rare, but you could imagine that situation in which there is an individual in a country like Yemen, right? I mean, you wouldn't allow it in a country, or we wouldn't allow it in an allied country, but in a country in which you couldn't actually get them in terms of, you know, the immediate threat that they pose to American lives, that there is a showing of who this person is, that you couldn't target U.S. citizens. We have done that, as most people remember. We killed a U.S. citizen in Yemen who was traveling with a terrorist, and could assassinate. That would be the sort of exception. But just to describe the structure here, this would be what those of us who, you know, think about this stuff. This would just be the rules that would be established for a covert operation.
All right. We've got a lot of listeners who want to get in on this discussion, too. So I want to go to Boston, first of all. Seth is on the line. Hi, Seth. And what do you make of all of this?
Hi. Well, actually, you just kind of hit on something that I'm very interested in. The one thing that worries me in this process is when you hear a U.S. citizen, due process gets thrown about a lot. I'm not concerned about due process or, you know, some guy hiding in Afghanistan. But when the U.S. citizens, and I mean, this does not go to torture or anything like that, obviously, but when U.S. citizens, you know, are kind of held by the military or assassinated in a group of people, that's when I kind of, to me at least, my line kind of gets crossed. And I think, now, wait a minute, this is where it becomes very scary. You know, I deserve, you know, protections. I deserve representation. I deserve the knowledge that my government can't just pick me off of the street and make me disappear. And I was wondering if you touch that distinction at all.
Well, I tell you what, let me throw that one to Emily first and then come back to Juliet. Emily, what about that? Is there a difference between citizens of the world and U.S. citizens in terms of the kind of protection that they ought to be afforded?
Well, there's certainly a difference legally, and I think that Juliet's report actually carries that distinction through, particularly in talking about who can be detained and under what conditions, and if U.S. citizens are captured on U.S. soil and abroad. Juliet's recommendations are that they be given the full protections of United States criminal law. And that, Seth, may seem like an obvious point to you. It wasn't entirely obvious last summer before the Supreme Court. The Bush administration had captured Jose Padilla, an American citizen, on U.S. soil and was arguing that he should be treated as an unlawful combatant and stripped of his due process protections.
And Juliet?
I just agree. The truth is we are somewhat parochial about this. But, yeah, I mean, for a variety of reasons, both legal and also fairness issues, that, U.S. citizens should have more rights, especially if they're here in America, but also abroad. And those are sort of played out throughout the report, but also are played out through the law. I mean, obviously, the international law community isn't in love with that idea, but I think it's pretty consistent with the rule structure out there.
And Emily, back to you on this matter of assassinations, targeted killings. Even some ardent civil libertarians would say, when it comes to Osama bin Laden, you know, it's okay with me if you get him. But is that sort of the slippery slope of how you define and where you draw the line that's of concern here?
Well, certainly it can be a slippery slope. And I think one of the things that Juliet's report, one of the ways in which it tries to prevent that slippery slope is by codifying these practices and requiring direct presidential authorization. You know, one of the more problematic aspects of the Bush administration's approach has been a lot of very important decisions have been made behind closed doors and without public debate, and sometimes without really writing down, or at least for public viewing, writing down what the policies are. So certainly the slippery slope danger is there, and one way to prevent it as much as possible is to make sure that the rules are clearly established. That's what the rule of law is all about.
And so your rules, your recommendations, Juliet, were on this point?
It would be, it would be permissible in limited circumstances.
Very limited.
Oh, very limited. I mean, it would, as a covert operation, we designate what level of evidence is necessary, what level of review is necessary, and it would require presidential authorization. So that you can get bin Laden, you could get top deputies, but, you know, there's a lot of bad people out there, and you simply don't want a system in which shoot to kill is the orders, especially in places where we're not technically at war, right? And outside of Iraq and Afghanistan, because that's really where this is going to get played out. In Iraq and Afghanistan, complicated series of rules regarding the laws of war and whether they're actually being applied right now in those two places. But when you talk about places like Yemen or areas of Pakistan, those are the places where this sort of stuff will get played out.
Let me ask you about the collection of information, mm-hmm. because that is such a sensitive point. You know, it does make sense on one level that, okay, if you want to build a case against people who are plotting harm against the U.S., right. you need information to credit cards and car rentals and email and phones and all of that. But, you know, what's the slippery slope there? A lot of people would say, wait a minute.
You know, yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to be a civil libertarian to, you know, I mean, all sorts of things we do, we don't want others to know we're doing them, whether they're lawful or not, or even if they are unlawful. It came to this notion that I think is a shared sentiment, a bipartisan shared sentiment, that it's not just our privacy as Americans that we like. It's something someone said, it's our anonymity that we like, that it's if I want to buy roses and send them to someone, I don't necessarily want, my credit card company's going to know. But it's different for the government to know. And right now, the government is collecting large amounts of information about lots of people that most people who are doing this think it's not going to be very helpful, because you're just sort of increasing the amount of information. It's not very targeted. It would be helpful, I think, realistically thinking, if there were a series of purchases, conduct or whatever else done that seemed to suggest fishy activity, right? Some sort of template or a series of templates that if you apply to this massive amount of information would suggest some activity that you would want to follow. An activity only related to terrorism, right? I mean, this is the slippery slope theory that Emily was talking about, or what in the military they call mission creep, right? You know, you don't want this stuff now starting to be used to go after people for, you know, much lesser crimes. But that, you know, the anonymity can be maintained, right? And that the only way that the government could find out who that person was as you put these templates together would be through a showing to a court. Then, in other words, once the information suggests you are doing something that looks exceptionally fishy when it comes to terrorism, then I get to find out it's Jane Doe. But the anonymity should be preserved, and I think that's something that most people sort of like. I mean,
Emily, just briefly before we have to take another break, is there a real case here that we can point to as well that should give us pause on this question about information gathering?
Well, I think certainly people are concerned that, you know, when they're going to check in at the airport, that the airlines are pulling them out of line based on some information about them, some list that the government may be compiling. There have been lawsuits brought by people who think they're on these lists, and the government has at times refused to disclose whether such lists exist, whose names are on them. So I think those are very real concerns.
Emily, thank you so much, and we're going to continue our discussion in just a moment. We're talking this hour about the legal landscape of the war on terrorism and how to strike a balance between security and liberty. Do we need clearer rules to fight against terrorism? Or should decisions about torture and assassination and information collection be left up to the president? Should government agents be able to come to your religious or political meeting? Would you consent to being fingerprinted or perhaps optically scanned to get into a baseball game? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. Over 3 years since the September 11th attacks, and the rules of the war on terrorism are still very much in debate. Tonight we're talking about a new Harvard University report that is attempting to find the right balance between security and the civil liberties on which the country was founded. So where do you draw the line between safety and liberty? Should there be rules about difficult issues like torture and assassination, or should the White House decide? Do clear regulations interfere with the fight against terrorism? terrorism or protect the American way of life? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Emily Bazelon, Senior Editor of Legal Affairs, and Juliet Kayyem, Co-Director of Harvard University's Long-Term Legal Strategy Project for Preserving Security and Democratic Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. We also want to hear from Steve, who's on the line from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Steve. Welcome. And what's your thought about this?
Well, good evening to you and your guests. Just a quick preface. I'm a very experienced interrogator myself. I'm a senior military officer now, and I've been involved in interrogations dating back to Panama. I used to teach it, actually, for a number of years. Mm-hmm. But what I'd like to offer is something to the debate that I think is overlooked. We're definitely arguing the legal aspects, and we're still searching for our moral compass from a national level. Mm-hmm. But some of these questions are almost moot because from an operational perspective, there's this buy-in to the assumption that in certain instances, I think the example used tonight was somebody who knew where a nuclear bomb was, that is very problematic to even assume that anybody knows. And then when you use coercive tactics, you apply enough pressure, people are going to say anything mm-hmm. to stop it. And so let's say the assumption is he knows 10 bits of information, when in reality he knows 5 bits. You know, you get the 5 bits, and then you keep the pressure on. It gives you 5 more erroneous, incorrect, poor intelligence that corrupts everything else. Interrogation really is nothing more than a collection mode, just like signals intelligence or imagery or anything else. And you can only push it so far before it is no longer of any value.
So, Steve, do you like the idea of having some clear rules here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, again, from an operational perspective, it supports it. But I think, you know, it's been said more eloquently than I that, you know, as a nation, we stop being great when we stop being good. And when we step over the line, it just tells the world where our heart lies. And
got it, Steve. Thank you so much for the call. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's exactly mm-hmm. what you were wrestling with for all that
yeah.
time.
I mean, and coming from an interrogator, I think that's definitely a sentiment that we heard a lot in our conversations. And yeah, I mean, I think to the extent that we would want such interrogations to be quite limited in both in nature and against whom they're done against, I think is sort of plays into his idea that it's going to be that rare situation, in fact, maybe even fictional, that the guy knows where the nuclear bomb is. We address it only because it seems to be a fear out there, but I think it is more rare than likely.
Well, what about something that's a little more nebulous, mm-hmm. and that is the surveillance of religious or political meetings? Make the security case, make the freedom
right.
case.
This is an issue where, you know, after 9/11, before 9/11, there was a series of attorney general guidelines that basically were interpreted to prohibit the FBI from attending open political and religious meetings, based once again on abuses in the 70s and 80s and during the civil rights movement. After 9/11, those guidelines were simply rescinded, and it was okay, wherever the public can go, the FBI agents can go. You know, now 3 years later, that seems, I mean, once again, it's like, you know, what the FBI agent can do is different than if you just show up at a mosque, especially when we know it's going to be mosques, right? It's not, you know, it's not synagogues and Catholic churches. It seems now a time to revisit, as we all thought, revisit that, the Attorney General guidelines again, and to only permit the FBI attendance at the open religious and political groupings with consistent with a reasonable indication that there's criminal activity going on. That's a standard we use in criminal law. That seems right. There's no evidence. There's all sorts of, you know, terrorist activity happening in public mosques. You know, I mean, it's so ridiculous. And I think it's time that we sort of just said, look, you know, let's all take a deep breath. This cuts to the core of First Amendment rights. It cuts to the core of a minority's rights, right, mosques. And we know, once again, mission creep has occurred. I mean, we've learned now that the FBI was in on anti-war rallies and demonstrations and stuff like that. And it's time. This was the thing where it was relatively easy to say, whatever we did after 9/11, let's revisit again.
And who should be in charge of that? What were your recommendations?
Well, I mean, the attorney general would still be in charge simply because it's the FBI. But the attorney general issues his or her guidelines, and the guidelines are followed by the FBI. It's consistent with the Fourth Amendment and other constitutional norms, and would require a written predicate of why you would ever need to enter a mosque. I mean, just make someone prove it before you open up all the mosque doors to surveillance and all the anti-war doors, you know, or whatever else.
And Emily, I want to ask you to stand by because Juliet's going to have to leave in just a minute. So I will want to hear from you in just a second. But while you're still in the chair, Juliet, let me ask you about one more thing, and that's the profiling question. If you could just quickly give us the security and the freedom argument on that point, and then we'll let you go.
Oh, yeah. No, it's sorry, I have to go. Profiling was also one of these issues where everyone said they were against it or everyone said they were for it, and no one knew actually what we were talking about, right? No one knows what profiling means. No evidence that profiling of the way someone looks or religious affiliation or even any profiling of U.S. citizens is neither, probably doesn't work and is not appropriate in a democratic society. Where I think the tougher question occurs, and one that we addressed and said it was permissible in limited circumstances, is the profiling of people not from this country who seek access to certain sensitive sites or certain activities that are suspicious, that you could require further information from them and further sort of proof of why they're doing that. It's once again, it's to many will seem quite parochial, but the truth is there's no proof that this profiling actually works, and it's too disruptive. It heralds back to an awful time in our nation's history to target U.S. citizens. And the tougher question is people visiting this country. And I think that we tried to create the distinctions that were appropriate, but that, you know, they're tough. This is a hard thing to talk about. I mean,
well, as you and your colleagues were wrestling with all of these issues and trying to decide, all right, well, who should be in charge of this one? The courts?
Right.
Should Congress? Should the White House?
Or a special court? Or
somebody else? Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you make that determination? And do you see any eagerness for these other institutions to pick up these tasks?
I don't know why they would, but, well, the election's over. That's our hope. I mean, it's a great point that you raise, which is there's not a cookie-cutter solution to any of this stuff. Sometimes we recommend it's congressional oversight. Sometimes it's a specialized foreign intelligence court. Sometimes it's a military court. I mean, look, there's no great solution to these really tough questions, and we have to be realistic about secrecy and fear and all sorts of things that are playing into our efforts against terrorism. We've gotten a lot of receptiveness. It's interesting. We've got a lot of receptiveness on the Hill, and there's a series of briefings, and we hope something might happen in January. More significantly, we've gotten tremendous interest within the administration from the sort of military guys, the military lawyers, the State Department people, the people who sort of outside the Justice Department, the more aggressive Justice Department. And it will be interesting to see what this Justice Department is like under a new attorney general. And I think that will be the interesting thing in January.
Well, it's a formidable piece of work. And thank you so much
well,
for being
for
with
having us
to explain it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Juliet.
Thank
let's go back to our phone lines now. I want to hear from Eric, who's on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Eric, what do you think about all this?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's really a particular interest to me because I teach political science and international studies in college, and so I'm trying to get my students to grapple with these kinds of issues in class. I have a couple of questions. First of all, you just left off talking about the role of other in political institutions in making some of these decisions, and I know that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court had been designed to handle at least some of the questions, for instance, having to do with wiretapping in national security cases, where in an ordinary criminal investigation, it's not so critical that the target doesn't know that he or she is a target. But in national security investigations, you don't want to let the target know through the public court forum that the person is a target, but there's still a legal process set up. And so I was wondering to what extent the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court could handle at least some of the processes that you were talking about. And then a second question that I had, and I'll take my answers to both of these offline. The second question that I had is that a lot of the things that you're talking about, the decision-making processes and the evidence underlying those decision-making processes are necessarily designed to be secret. And if they're to be effective in a national security sense, they have to be secret as well. But that secrecy undermines the public accountability. I mean, if that information can't be released to the public about how those decisions were made, then how can the public hold our elected officials accountable?
Okay, Eric, let me stop you there because that's two really big pieces to chew on. Emily?
Well, let me start with your second question. And I certainly, you know, you have your finger on an important tension between secrecy and public accountability. And, you know, one answer, and I think this report tries to do this, just to say, all right, well, look, even if we can't see for ourselves the classified evidence against someone being held at Guantanamo Bay, we need to know what processes are in place so that we understand how that person's rights are being protected. You know, the administration's response to the Supreme Court rulings last summer were to set up combatant status review tribunals, which did not provide lawyers to the detainees. They were given advisors from the military who were obligated to report back to the military what the detainees told them. So, you know, that's a kind of process, but in letting the American people know that that is the sort of review, the Bush administration is sending a clear message about the sort of process it really sees as possible. And, you know, last week, a federal judge in Washington, D.C. said that that was not an acceptable practice, that the suspension of the Geneva Conventions in this context was not permissible.
Emily, I also want to Eric, thank you for the call, by the way. And Emily, let me pursue the point that I was asking Juliet about just a moment ago about who's going to take all this on, because you know it is so tricky trying to strike this balance. It's tempting, I'm sure, to just say, well, let the president deal with it. What's your sense of how we're going to be able to get at some of these very thorny decisions?
Well, I think, you know, Juliet's call for Congress to really step up and play a role is an important one. And it's important to emphasize that now, 3 years after 9/11, the sort of notion that we're still in a kind of state of emergency, making up rules as we go along, really should be dispelled. How do we get Congress to take on this very thorny issue? I think that some political pressure needs to be applied. You know, one thing I was really struck by when I was in Jordan is how different this country's war on terror and its tactics are perceived abroad. You know, in Europe and in the Middle East, there's a lot of real upset and concern at the sort of sense that Americans are letting go of so many of our sort of core freedoms and treating non-citizens in these kind of abusive or unthinking manners without realizing that there's a real sort of pragmatic argument that these things cause problems for American citizens abroad. If we suspend the Geneva Conventions for people we capture here, then how are we supposed to ask for those protections to apply to our soldiers if, you know, they're captured? Those sorts of concerns.
Hmm. And where do you think this balance is going to fall with presumably, or some might say, more security-conscious Republicans who control the White House and Congress and the courts, and especially now that the former White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, has been nominated as Attorney General? He was in the White House making a lot of these decisions and recommendations about holding people and, you know, putting people under surveillance.
Well, Alberto Gonzalez is a really interesting character in this. You know, he has this kind of amazing resume. He was born to migrant farm workers in San Antonio. He has a history of being in the Air Force and also being at Harvard Law School and a partner in an elite law firm. But he is very much the White House's man. And in his role as White House counsel, as you were saying, he really helped to sort of push forward some of these practices, which have been a really radical departure from past administrations and their approach to the rule of law. Now Gonzalez is in a different role. He, you know, as the Attorney General, has a sort of broader set of responsibilities. He can't simply be the advocate for the White House's point of view. And so while I think the civil libertarians might be given pause by some of his past actions, I would hold out some hope that in his new role he might take a different sort of approach.
Emily, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Gail.
Emily Bazelon is senior editor of Legal Affairs magazine. Earlier this hour, we spoke with Juliet Kayyem, former member of the National Commission on Terrorism, and part of this Harvard University study on preserving security in the war on terrorism. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point.